Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for our regular dive into the news, and it has stopped raining just long enough for me to introduce our National Director, John Stevens. Hello, John.
Hi, Phil. I got absolutely soaked last night walking in the rain in London because the escalator at the underground station was broken and I had to walk to another one.
Oh, there we are. So John has been experiencing the rain, and Adrian Reynolds, our Associate National Director.
Hello. I've been out sending out the FIEC Raven to see if it will return.
Has he come back with an olive branch in its mouth or anything
that?
Like
that wasn't
that.
The raven, but
no,
yes.
Yeah. The dove. Excellent. Very, very good. Well, welcome to the podcast. Time for our regular dive into the news. Before we look at some of the stories we've been thinking about this last couple of weeks, a couple of bits of FIEC news. So local conferences started this week, Adrian. So up in Sunderland, last week, I should say, they began. We had our first one there.
They're all around the country. They're like a rash, but good.
One of 33 last week.
33.
Was,
yeah, so yeah. Wherever you are, you should be within reasonable reach of one of the local conferences. We'll put a link in the show notes as to where they are. They're great to get along to because they're a good day of fellowship, of meeting other leaders. You might do that anyway, but actually to have some structured content. They're thinking about the topic of unity under the title One New Humanity. So it's a great opportunity actually to wrestle with some of the things that we find difficult as church leaders, but we know are important for us as church leaders. And also it's a good opportunity to rub shoulders with different kinds of church leaders. It's not just for pastors, it's for people in any kind of church leadership. And actually, people who are in lay leadership are very welcome as well. Sometimes the leaders' conference in November, it's a bit difficult for, you know, a lay elder or someone like that to access. Maybe it's a bit too long, a bit too expensive, but actually a single day can be really manageable. Certainly our church, we send a group of lay leaders along to benefit from the local conference in Leicester. So yeah, make the most of them, I would say.
We're saying they're a key part of our strategy. I mean, FIEC, we exist to be independent churches working together to reach Britain for Christ. A key part of the way we do that is helping churches to connect. We want churches to connect in their local areas and in their regions to be able to support one another in the work of the gospel. That also fits with our desire to want to see local directors working all around the country, helping and supporting our churches. So the local conferences serve a key role of building and fostering that cooperation at a local level. And at all the local conferences, there'll be central FIEC staff as well, who are there to kind of meet church leaders, engage with them, and again, just build those relationships.
Unity across cultures and across genders is part of the day. It's a really fantastic opportunity to think about that and build on what we did actually at the Leaders Conference together back in November, which was a great joy. Our Easter event is on the horizon, John. Rising Lights coming up 6th to the 10th of April. Time to come along to get tickets, but as we said a couple of weeks ago, children's bookings will close on the 23rd of February, so just after half term. So if you are planning to bring your family, now's the time to book.
Absolutely, yes. So book particularly for the children. Those are in sort of short supply. For adults, there are lots of options for coming to Rising Lights. An adult ticket costs about £160 to come. We've got some options which are kind of half board. You can book for Rising Lights and get a hotel room with bed and breakfast and an evening meal that's very near to the conference centre. So if you want a convenient way to book, that's available on the website. And at the moment, a key opportunity for students to be able to come and join us. So we know students tend to book late and they're pretty price sensitive. We'd love to see more students coming to Rising Lights. We dropped the student prices because we wanted to make it accessible. So it now costs just £50.
Just £50,
just
John.
£50,
that's extraordinary.
For a student to be able to come to Rising Lights and take advantage of that kind of great Bible teaching, range of seminars, some material being run by UCCF for those who are 19 to 24s. And again, there's lots of accommodation available in Torquay that is cost effective. Cheapest I found is you can hire a caravan on the edge of Torquay, which if you had six students staying in it, it would cost them each £95 to come, accommodation and Rising Lights, which is a bargain. So why not encourage students to come? If you're a church with students in it, why not encourage them to come along?
And just to be clear, the adult ticket is not about 160 quid. It's exactly 160
I spent this morning, Phil, planning some of the music with Phil Moore, who's going to be leading some of the music with Cornerstone Worship. And it's just a great reminder, actually, that the thrill of coming together at events like this is not just the enjoyment, it's the gathering. We gather every Sunday as a church. We're not replacing that at events like these. But what we're doing is we're giving people kind of a heightened experience of it, if you like. And there's something thrilling about, you know, sitting in an auditorium with 1,000, 1,200 other people and singing the praises of God, raising our voices, learning new songs, singing great old favourites, listening to good teaching together. That just stirs the heart. Yeah. And actually, I've been talking to some of the evening preachers as well. And it's what we're trying to do in the evening celebration. Christians, we're just trying to encourage people to keep going, keep fixing their eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of their faith. And that's a great thing to be doing.
It's worth saying there's loads of opportunity for fun for those who come as well. So we want it to be a really Kingdom fun
Bank
and enjoyable time.
Frisbees. Can I just say those three words? Kingdom Bank Frisbees. There we go.
Yeah, free Frisbees. We've got a Lego room. There are inflatables that the kids can play on. There's actually a leisure centre and swimming pool right next door to the centre. Paddle tennis. There's a mini golf just next door. The beach is just a few minutes walk away, and loads of stuff in Torquay.
There is going to be a Ryder Cup of mini golf.
When you say mini golf, you mean crazy golf, don't you, basically?
Well, you know, I take it quite seriously, Phil. I don't want to call it crazy.
It's like one of those with mini stone castles that you've got to avoid with your golf ball, isn't it?
No, it's more than that. I think it's jungle adventure golf. Oh, actually, well, there we are. It's the full deal.
I stand corrected.
It's still the Ryder Cup.
Yeah, very.
He was a member, Samuel Ryder, who started the Ryder Cup, was a member of an FIZ church.
I know we've heard about that this past couple of weeks. Very, very exciting. Yeah. So we're going to make some reference to that, perhaps. Let me give a plug for something I've got over the line for Rising Lights this week, which is train travel. You can now book a return ticket from Paddington to Torquay for £69 if you're coming to Rising Lights. And you have to get the train there. It's kind of a fixed time, but then it's completely flexible. You can come back on any train you want at the end of Rising Lights.
Well done,
Phil. So that's a really good thing as well, which we've sent out to everybody who's booked in this past week. Right. Let's talk a bit about what's been going on in the news, because it has not been quiet, brothers, has it, this past couple of weeks?
Is it ever?
Well, what? I mean, it seems to be particularly busy this past sort of 10 days or so. Let's start with the government and particularly the position of the Prime Minister. As you'll know, a week or so back, a whole load more files were released in relation to the late financier, paedophile, disgraced Jeffrey Epstein. Lots of mention made in there of the rich and powerful who were in his kind of circle. And of course, one of those was Peter Mandelson, who'd been US ambassador. Now, we knew this before. Peter Mandelson had lost his role. We talked about that previously on the podcast. But there was an audible gasp at last week's Prime Minister's questions when the Prime Minister was asked, did he know about Lord Mandelson's ongoing links with Jeffrey Epstein when he appointed him? And he said that he did. And there was a kind of a collective intake of breath in the Commons. I've got to be honest, as a former journalist, I thought it was the beginning of the end for the Prime Minister, but things since then seem to have been shored up a little bit for him. His ex-chief of staff has resigned, Morgan McSweeney. Somebody there has taken responsibility.
The Prime Minister of Communications.
Yeah, exactly. The Prime Minister is still in his role. There doesn't suddenly seem to be an appetite to remove him, as there seemed to be a groundswell of earlier in the week. What can we learn from all this? Should he have gone? Do you take responsibility? They're good questions, aren't they?
Personally, I think he should have gone.
Yeah, I agree.
But that's kind of, we're making both political and moral judgments all wrapped up together. And I think that complicates it a little bit. I had a really helpful phone call this morning with James Mildred, who is an elder in an FIC church. He works for CARE, who do a lot of lobbying and work with the government. And in fact, he's running a track for us at Rising Lights about beginning and end of life issues. He said to me he thinks Starmer is safe for now.
Oh, well, I agree now, yes. But I didn't think that to
but
begin
he thinks
with.
That may change in May because of the local election results. But he said to me something quite interesting, which was helpful, that this is a political decision. It's not a moral decision. People are making decisions based on political expediency. You know, what's going to get them through? What can they get away with in terms of, you know, keeping the party together and all those sorts of things? So I don't think there doesn't seem to be any appetite within the Labour Party for an election. There doesn't seem to be any appetite amongst the centrist MPs in the Labour Party to move to the left, which is almost certainly what would happen if there were an election. People like Andy Burnham or Angela Rayner would come into the frame. So there's a feeling that they want to remain in the terms of the spectrum, they want to remain where they are. So I think what's difficult to identify from a Christian point of view is we might have a moral view of whether what he did was right or wrong. And other people will have a moral view of what he did was right or wrong. But that is all wrapped up within political expediency as well. I think when it comes to leadership questions in the church, they are clearer cut than that. I think if there are moral issues and if there are moral failings of the kind that are worthy of a resignation, you don't start making a political point. Well, it'd be better if we just, you know, better for the kingdom if we keep going. That's the disreputable way to think about leadership. So I think it's more complex with government posts. It's not simply a moral question. And we see that in leadership roles all around the world, I think.
John?
I think it's all very sordid and sad. Mm. He has obviously survived for the moment, but shouldn't forget here the reality is that Jeffrey Epstein, a very powerful man with a lot of money, has basically abused huge numbers of young women, many of them underage, who he has exploited himself, who he's trafficked to others. And a whole load of people have been happy to associate with him and take money from him, knowing full well that that's what he was doing, keeping contact with him after he'd been convicted and was released. So I find it astonishing, the idea that Sarah Ferguson would fly to meet him with her daughters just days after he's released from prison for basically abusing kind of young girls. Obviously, some of these people are motivated by money and all that they've got from Epstein. But I think there's a whole load of people who have been exposed as being deeply compromised by pursuing those friendships with somebody who they knew was an abuser. We're not talking here about people who didn't know that somebody was an abuser or might have had some suspicion, but it wasn't really fully clear. These are people who consciously knew that that's what they were doing, and they'd been sucked into this world. We don't know exactly how much Keir Starmer knew. He would
and
say,
to be clear, well, he was, he's not, yeah. not, no one's saying he no. was a friend of Epstein. No.
He, you know, he has admitted that he was told that Mandelson had kept up a relationship with Epstein even after he'd been convicted. But he would say that he wasn't given the full facts on that, that Mandelson lied about the degree of his connections with Epstein. And it's been very clear, actually, that Keir Starmer does seem to have been extraordinarily angry about the way that Mandelson has sort of behaved. Having said that, there were people in his team and in the cabinet who warned him not to appoint Peter Mandelson, and he chose still to go ahead knowing that Mandelson had this ongoing relationship, or have had some kind of ongoing relationship with...
including Gordon Brown, I think, who wrote to him as an ex-prime minister.
Clearly, other people have taken the fall for him. So McSweeney and others, they have fallen on their swords and claimed that they take full responsibility. At one level, the Prime Minister is ultimately the person who made the decision.
Well, the book stops with him, doesn't it?
Yeah. But, I mean, he will say, I knew something, but I didn't know enough. And I guess we haven't yet seen all of the documents. All of this is going to go to the Intelligence Committee. So there may well be much more that would come out at this stage. But yeah, I think it shows a lack of moral compass that a whole load of people have basically become associated with Epstein in that way. As I said, fully knowing that he was an abuser and had been abusing. And I mean, even today we hear documents released that seem to sort of indicate that Donald Trump knew back in 2006. So police officer saying that Donald Trump had told him that in 2006, everybody knew what Epstein was doing. So there's just mounting evidence of a whole load of people who were fully aware of what was happening and yet either took part in it or allowed it to, or wanted things from Epstein.
And everyone turned a blind eye.
Yeah, well, I mean, not just a blind eye. They were actively courting his friendship, money, approval, and what they could gain from him. And that is a deep warning to us of the dangers of sin. I mean, biblically, there's a principle of separation. There is a right separation that we are to exercise from ungodliness and unwickedness. Mm. And actually, biblically, that kind of come out from amongst them. There's a sense in which we live in the world and we have to live alongside sinners and we want to communicate the gospel to them. But this kind of partnership, friendship, involvement, engagement are all things that Christians are commanded to avoid. That's for the protection of our own godliness and purity. That is for the protection of the reputation of the church. And we need to take that really seriously.
We've got a fine line to tread there, haven't we? Because... I've got three daughters.
We're all fathers of daughters.
Got fans.
Absolutely.
So I find it very difficult to read all this stuff and read about it. And when there's just another article today and another article the next day, another article the next day, I just want to put my fingers in my ears, Phil, really, and pretend it's not happening. Yeah. I don't think that honours the victims. I'm not wanting to find out what happens because of the salaciousness of it or the gossip of it. But I think those who have been victims, you do need to honour them. They do need the pursuit of justice at that point. So I think in church life, we mustn't just put our fingers in our ears and pretend that bad things don't happen in the world. We have to lament. Mm. And I think, and this is the hardest thing, we have to keep lamenting with the same degree of intensity. I think we become inured to things, don't we? You know, we don't talk about Ukraine anymore. terrible things happening in Ukraine, because we become a little bit numbed to it. And I think somehow we've got to retain a sensitivity that does not allow us to be numbed by the evils in the world. So actually we can properly lament. Otherwise, you know, the situation that happens tomorrow, that someone much closer to home would say, oh, well, you know, I've heard it all before. We must never say that. Yeah. We must never say that. So I think somehow we've got to retain that right balance.
Well, I think at the same time, sometimes for victims, what they want is people to be held account who've been responsible and complicit and involved in this. And I think you always feel with this, there's obviously more to the story. Mm. So when you read of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor taking girls back to Buckingham Palace or Royal Lodge or whatever, you think, well, people must have known that. Mm. You know, there's a staff, there's a situation.
Yes, and it's like Ghislaine Maxwell, isn't it?
And you think, actually, this is not just one individual doing something hidden in the background. These are things that are presumably taking place in a more public context, or at least in a private context in which officials and others are aware of what's happening. So who knew is always a question with these kinds of scandals where it's revealed that there has been wrongdoing. The issue becomes who knew, who facilitated, who allowed it to happen. And I understand that what victims want is to, in a sense, see those who are responsible brought to account for that. Sometimes it can be very difficult to demonstrate and prove what happened, particularly if people close in and don't speak. But I think for victims, that is a part of closure that it's right for people to try to work towards.
Interesting that yesterday Virginia's law was proposed in the States, which would mean that the statute of limitations would be abandoned. Yeah. Therefore, there would be justice for those who were victims many, many years ago, which currently in the States isn't the case.
And we shouldn't forget, I mean, sort of abuse is tragically part of a fallen and sinful world, and we need to be on guard against it. That's why as churches, we need to be so careful with our safeguarding policies, with our DBS checks of people who are doing things. But we must never forget that actually most abuse takes place in the home. I was at a church the other day where they were announcing a seminar, especially about safeguarding in the home, which was wanting people in the church to be just conscious of the risks in the home situation. So domestic violence, sort of sexual abuse within the home. And I don't think we should be naive and think that that doesn't happen. We need to take it extremely seriously. And we do all have some measure of collective responsibility to put in place the appropriate safeguards. And if anything is raised, to deal with that properly.
Yeah, I mean, interesting. We had a sermon on Sunday at church.
Very sobering.
From 2 Peter, which is a sobering passage. Mm. And the pastor, the preacher, explicitly said, you know, invited people that if there are things that they're concerned about or worried about, you know, these are the mechanisms in church. And I think that was a good example of an application where we are telling people in church, reminding people in church, these are the mechanisms. Please do use them. Yeah. We need you to use them.
Let's move on from that to talk about another story that's hit the headlines this last couple of weeks. This is about the US President Donald Trump, who posted a video on social media, which he didn't evidently watch till the end, or the staffer who posted it, depending on the version of events, didn't watch till the end. So we get to the end of the video, and there's clearly a racist depiction of Barack and Michelle Obama, the former president, and his wife. Initially, the White House defended this, saying there was nothing to see here. But then the post was removed at the White House, saying that it was put up by a staffer and that the president didn't know what had happened with it. There's quite a lot of lessons in here, I think, in terms of who's responsible for the things that we put out under our name. Do we make sure we know what they look like, even watching right till the end? And do we defend things that are, at least on the surface, to me at least, absolutely indefensible?
Well, I think that's worth saying. I think it is indefensible.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it's racist.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people have tried to say it's not, but it seems to me it is racist. I can't see
there's no other way of interpreting it, in my opinion. No. Yeah.
And so I think, you know, maybe we'll come on to the various explanations, but we need to say that out front. I think, you know, these kinds of depictions are not acceptable and shouldn't have been allowed.
Mm. I think it's utterly shocking. Mm. I mean, it's a classic racist trope that anybody seeing it should have been deeply disturbed by it.
I didn't think it was real when I saw it. Yeah, I just thought somebody's made this up. Yeah, but no, it was real.
And of course, one of the reasons why this is so incendiary is because actually on the right wing, some of the supporters of right wing populist candidates are actually racist, openly so on social media. There have been supporters of Trump who are openly Nazi in their affiliations and what they're speaking about. So there's a whole group out there of people who are effectively racist. The whole sort of idea of the great replacement theory is a kind of a racist kind of view of the world that's got a lot of traction. So there is racism out there, and it appears to pander to that sort of way of thinking. And that's, I think, what makes it so completely shocking is that there is a genuine racism that is at play that often is not called out in the way that it ought to be.
And the indefensible was initially defended, Adrian.
Yes, it was defended in many different ways, which clearly demonstrated, I think, that the White House didn't have its kind of spin factory working. So there was one person defending it one way, one person defending it another way, one person giving one story, one person giving another story. You know, first of all, President Trump hadn't watched it to the end. Then it was done by a staffer. And so actually, it was clearly, there was a lot of backpedaling to try and get all the ducks in a row, which again, I think is, just a very ugly and grubby, that clearly something has happened and people aren't willing to admit that it has happened. And so they're just trying to come up with an excuse that doesn't matter whether it's true or not. But yes, initially it was defended as you rightly say, nothing to see here, but quickly backpedaled as they began to see the force of the force of the response, I think.
And then, of course, it was removed, but the US president didn't apologise, said he'd done nothing wrong.
Yeah, we don't know exactly how it got there, but the failure to issue an apology, even if it was there by mistake, unintentional, I didn't know, he should clearly have apologised.
He did say it was unacceptable, by the way. Yeah, we should give him his due for that, but he didn't apologise for it being posted.
I think for me, the great shock has been reading Christians online defending it. Obviously, some people who are so strongly supportive of Donald Trump that they're not even prepared to countenance any kind of criticism. So they have defended what's happened. Either he didn't mean it or it was accidental. Or in fact, some have said, oh, well, yes, of course it was unacceptable, but actually the outrage of others is just the Democrats whipping it up and they shouldn't be anywhere near as angry about it as they are. And you just think that is just a total failure to understand the seriousness of the situation and to properly call out what ought to be called out, because you've become so bound to support of Donald Trump, no matter what he does. And it shouldn't be forgotten, this is the very day on which he appeared at the presidential prayer breakfast. And I think of this sort of almost adulation of Donald Trump by some leaders who seem to fail to be able to kind of exercise it. That's not to say that every policy that Trump has adopted is wrong or inappropriate. We don't have to take that view either. But as Christians, we need to be rightly critical of, in everyone, what we see to be wrong and unacceptable, and to call it out, and not to give a loyalty to any other human being, which is so total and absolute that it's incapable of acknowledging and recognizing their real faults.
How often should leaders be apologizing, do you think? So what I mean by that is, leaders make mistakes like everybody else does. What should it look like in our leadership when mistakes like that have been, not like this necessarily, but when we make mistakes?
So there are different kinds of mistakes.
Yeah, of course.
I think we should always be seeking forgiveness. And I think if we've done things publicly, we need to admit them publicly. That's my sort of rule of thumb. If we've done things privately, we need to sort them out privately. So I had to do that last week. I slightly lost my temper with a colleague, so I'm not defending myself, I just shouldn't have done it, and I had to apologise for that, and that's right, and that's how it should be, and then it's all fine. Mm-hmm. I think when things are public, that does take it to a different level. But even then, there are different kinds of mistakes that we make. There are, might we call them casual mistakes, which are inadvertent. We've upset someone, or we've said something we didn't realise it was offensive, or we didn't realise it didn't quite, it struck the wrong tone. And we need to own those, but that's different from when there's something that we should jolly well have known was offensive and racist in this case. I think those are different categories. So it's quite a complex picture, I think, Phil. My rule of thumb is, public mistakes need public apologies, and seeking a public forgiveness, and private ones need private.
I absolutely do think people should apologise. That's an acknowledgement that they've done something wrong. The level of apology will be depending on, in a sense, the seriousness of what was done, the intentionality with which it was done, and the harm that's been caused to other people. Although, having said that, apology is not a particularly big biblical theme. From a biblical perspective, what people need to do is confess and repent and make restitution in as far as that is needed. So I think those are more helpful categories to think about what we're to do where we failed in a way that is sinful. Is it's a turning away from that and a wanting to demonstrate that we are no longer wanting to live in that way. We wish we'd not done it. We're sorrowful about it and we're wanting to head in a different direction. Confession is the acknowledging that it was wrong. And in some ways, it's the seeking the forgiveness of God and the seeking the forgiveness of the person.
Not regret then, that's not a biblical category.
Not in and of itself. No, regret might be part of repentance, but it's not sufficient in itself.
That's the way that people seem to apologise without even apologising. Yeah, they regret something.
And then actually that making of restitution to the person who has been harmed and hurt in an appropriate way. So I think apology is something that the world practices. Actually, what we're called to do is just something much deeper than that.
Is an apology part of that restitution ever, though?
It may be. You're acknowledging to the person that you've wronged them, that you wish you hadn't wronged them, that you wish you could undo it. Actually, if it's a matter of harm and it's not financial or whatever, that restitution is more psychological perhaps than actually in some material way. So yes, it can be an appropriate way of seeking to bring about a sort of an appropriate restitution to the person and their harmed feelings, and also a restoration of relationship.
Just finally on this, got to be careful what we say and put out in public, haven't we?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely right. And I think social media is especially bad for, the kind of immediate reactive stuff, not really thinking about stuff, got to get something out. If you think about the thought you put into a sermon, I hope, compared to the thought someone puts into a tweet or whatever it might be, social media post. I think we've got to be especially careful with those immediate forms of communication. And a lot of churches find this. I mean, churches find that, WhatsApp groups, very practical for communicating with church members, but they can be incendiary. If someone says something just casually and it all blows up, most church leaders have had situations like that they've had to diffuse. And so I think, especially in larger churches, it's good to think about how those different communication channels work. If you have a WhatsApp group, sometimes it's good to have some guidelines as to how it's going to work. And if you have a WhatsApp group, if you set it up as a community group, that can help in terms of how it's presented and how people respond. So there are some things you can do. But yes, I think it's that social media immediacy, I think, is a particularly dangerous area.
I think particularly in the area of reposting things or links to things, if you haven't actually watched it all the way through, if you haven't read it all the way through, it might say something that subsequently you regret very much that you have reposted. So it's taking the time to do that.
Well, it's more complex than that, isn't it? Because the thing, you may have watched a thing all the way through, but the same person may have posted something else quite objectionable.
Yeah, yeah.
And as soon as you repost something that person A has said, if you go and say, oh, who's this person A? Oh, wow, he says that. So actually reposting itself, I think, is just very dangerous.
But and also simply liking things and doing them. Sort of, you see a headline or you see a phrase and you think, well, I want to do that. And I suspect the two major danger areas are where you feel angry about the world and somebody seems to be saying something that you agree with and you want to express agreement for that, but you've not carefully thought about what they say and the tone with which they say it. The other is humour and comedy, where we're very easily prone to like something which we find funny without really thinking about the impact this might have on others. And actually, so kind of rushing in out of anger or because we find something funny, we just need to be much more careful. And that's what the Bible talks about, being careful in our speech. Mm-hmm. We're not to be rushing in quickly. We are to be sober and thoughtful in what we say and the tone in which we say it.
Last couple of minutes, let's talk about somebody else who regretted something that he agreed to do 493 days ago. This is a chap called Frank Illett. Frank Illett is a podcaster, also a supporter of Manchester United Football Club. And back in 2024, he said he would not cut his hair.
8 managers ago?
Well, he said he would not cut his hair until Manchester United won 5 games in a row. We're now 493 days into this, and this gentleman has still not cut his hair. He was live streaming Man United's game against West Ham earlier this week, because if they'd won that, that would have been the fifth game, but now he's had to reset the clock.
We were at St Pancras station very late last night, John and I, and the Manchester United fans were coming through, delighted that they had equalised in the 96th minute.
But not a win.
But they didn't win.
So he couldn't cut his hair. I mean,
have you thought about this for Bolton Wanderers as an approacher?
I won't cut my hair until we next win one game. Never mind five in a row.
I thought Phil had been saying he wasn't going to grow his hair until they cut five games in a row.
Hair growing games are not in my wheelhouse, brothers and sisters, as you will know if you watch this podcast. But there is something in there, isn't there, about saying things rashly, perhaps in the heat of the moment, that we then feel bound to stick to. It comes back again to being careful what we say.
Well, absolutely. And actually, there's a biblical principle here. I mean, it's a sort of silly story, but actually there's a serious point. The Bible does indeed warn against making rash vows, that people make vows to either sort of say something about themselves or to try to change the world or change other people. Actually then as a vow, that is something you are supposed to keep. And the Bible says it is foolish to make rash vows like that. I mean, the supreme example, go and read the story of Jephthah in the book of Judges, who makes the rash vow that he will sacrifice the first thing that comes out of his house when he comes back from winning the victory. And it's his daughter, and it's an absolutely terrible story. And it's actually revealing the stupidity and the sin of making foolish kind of vows. It's a kind of a time in Israel's history in which people do what they think is right in their own eyes. And it's there as a powerful warning. And that might seem a silly story, but the principle there is exactly how many people have ended up doing something stupid because they said before their friends something that they're going to do, or they promised to do something, and then they kind of can't back away from it, and they lose face and they face shame, and so they do something utterly stupid.
Also, I think, Phil, in 1 Timothy 4, faith is listed as one of the qualities of godliness in leaders. I think in the context, and this is also true of Galatians 5 in the fruit of the Spirit, faith there, which is a complex word and can be translated lots of different ways, is faithfulness. It's trustworthiness. It's being true to your word. So I think the flip side of this is the quality we're looking for in leaders is actually people who can be depended upon to do what they say. So the negative side of that is we mustn't make rash promises about our hair growing or about more serious things. But equally, when we do say we will do things, when we do say we will go and see someone, when we do say we will help someone with something, when we do commit to something, as leaders, we have to follow through on that. And I think that's one of the qualities that Paul is urging Timothy to develop in himself and to grow in. And we want to be growing in as leaders. People need to be able to depend on us and take us at our word.
It brings to my mind Gary Lineker saying that he would present Leicester, Manchester United in his underpants.
Match of the day, you mean?
Match of the day. What did I say?
Leicester. It was Leicester.
Leicester won the Premier League.
He said if Leicester won, he'd present in his underpants. And he did.
And he had to, He said something rash on social media and it came back to haunt him. And another one, the most famous one probably, is Mark Lawrenson shaving off his tash because Bolton stayed in the Premier League in 1990, whenever it was, 2000 and something. Very good. Brothers, we've come to the end. Thank you for talking about what's been going on in the news.
No more football stories, please.
No more next time. We will avoid that. But there we are. It's been good to talk about what's been going on in the news. Hope this has helped you as you think about your work and ministry. Do like and leave a review so others can find it. And we will look forward to speaking to you again soon. God bless.